It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is in India. He met yesterday with the Prime Minister, and today Geithner is in India's financial capital, Mumbai, meeting with chief executives and entrepreneurs. Even though India has long been hailed as the next big thing, and it's one of the world's fastest-growing economies, many investors have been disappointed with opportunities there. To talk about this, we called up the editor of the Indian newspaper, The Business Standard. Sanjaya Baru is in Delhi. Glad to have you back on the program.
Oh, nice to hear you, Rani.
You know, let's begin with that. For years, U.S. executives have been complaining about a lack of openness in India's economy and saying it's limiting what they can do there. What do you think? Are India's rules a turnoff for foreign investors?
I don't think that's fair. Actually, first of all, that's history. I mean, for the last 15 years or more, we have been as open as any other modern economy. But there are a couple of sectors in which we are not yet open. One of them happens to be banking. The second is retail. And after the global financial crisis, I think most people around the world are giving India a lot of brownie points for not having moved too fast in opening up on the banking sector. We would have gone under, like many countries around the world, if we had been more open than we now are.
Well, you know, many of America's most famous brands are well established in India, McDonald's, General Electric. But there are other big companies
also, Rene, Citibank. Citibank is in India. Merrill Lynch used to be here till it closed up. So there are, in fact, American financial institutions functioning in India.
You know, it seems like India is always being compared to China, with China mm-hmm. being pointed to as the place to do business. I mean, emerging middle class, 10% mm-hmm. growth rate, hundreds of millions of potential consumers. Why do you think that, though? Because India itself is so huge and has a middle class and has a high growth rate.
First of all, you know, India is a free market democracy. And like in all democracies, we have our trade unions, who make it difficult for investors. The Chinese don't have any trade unions, so American companies find it easier to invest in China because they don't have to worry about trade union problems. But the second reason, I think, is that we have a private sector. India has Indian private companies, like you have General Motors, like you have Ford, like you have Rockefeller. Now, China is not a democracy. Chinese government doesn't have to worry about local businessmen. The government in Beijing decides, everybody falls in line. So I think that's a fundamental difference between the way in which you would do business in India and the way in which you would have to do business in China. But I think having said that, I have seen studies done at the Harvard School of Business which show that profitability in India actually is higher for American companies. You know, they make more money for a given amount of investment in India than they do in China. So I think we have been very bad in getting this message across to more American companies.
Well, you know, all in all, observing from your position there as editor of the Business Standard, what do you think is the most important thing that would come out of this visit?
Well, I think we are certainly looking for more U.S. investment in India. There was a momentum to the India-U.S. relationship during the Bush presidency, and that momentum had slowed down in the first year of the Obama presidency. And I think here in India, we are waiting for the Obama administration to catch up and move ahead. And I'm really hoping that Mr. Geithner's visit will restore the momentum to the bilateral relationship.
Thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you, Rani.
Sanjaya Baru is editor of the Business Standard newspaper. He's also a former spokesman for India's prime minister.
The trip to India is just the beginning of the Treasury Secretary's travels. Timothy Geithner will hold talks in Beijing, China, on Thursday. And those talks come at a time when both countries, China and the U.S., have been arguing over the value of China's currency. We're going to talk about that and some more with David Wessel. He's economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a frequent guest here. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What makes China's currency a matter of concern for the United States?
Well, unlike most major economies in the world, China is holding its currency steady against the dollar. It's not allowing it to rise against the dollar, and that makes it easier for them to export stuff to the United States and harder for us to export stuff to them. It's one of the major frictions in the world economy. The U.S. has been pressuring China to let the currency rise Geithner's trip suggests to me that there's some deal in the works, that China's on the verge of doing something that might allow its currency to gradually rise against the dollar as it was before the global financial crisis.
Just to be totally clear on this, you're saying that when China holds its currency artificially low, that means Chinese goods are especially cheap in the United States and we buy more of them, and American goods are especially expensive in China, and at least in theory, they buy less of our stuff. Is that right?
Exactly. And the strategy for the world economy right now, in a simple formula, is the U.S. needs to export more and China needs to export less, and a change in the value of the exchange rate between the Chinese currency and the American currency has got to be part of that adjustment, most economists believe.
Although, let me ask, can that really make a significant difference? Because even if the currency moves a little bit, China's still going to be producing really, really, really cheap goods, and we're not going to be.
It's not alone going to change the balance in the world economy. It's kind of an essential part of the adjustment, though. China needs to do things to get its people to save a little less and buy a little more. It needs to invest more in its own infrastructure. That's the U.S. view. And if that happens, the currency has to change. Otherwise, they'll be forced to spend billions and billions of dollars of intervening in currency markets and building this huge hoard of American treasury bonds. And that's a sign that they are kind of interfering with the market forces.
We're talking with David Wetzel of The Wall Street Journal about some numbers that can affect the economy and also are affected by it. And let's move on to another number, if you don't mind, David. Interest rates, which of course can change everything from people's credit card payments to the house they buy to the financial health of our employers. The Federal Reserve is at the center of the debate about interest rates because it's kept the rates that it controls exceptionally low. And I suppose the question, David Wetzel, is how long the interest rates will stay that low.
Well, a while longer. The Federal Reserve this week put out minutes of its meeting in March. There's always a lag before they put them out. And it shows the economy, the officials still very worried about the fragility of the economic recovery, worried about the waning effects of the fiscal stimulus, about high unemployment, about how weak housing prices are. And actually, although we're accustomed to Fed officials always worrying that inflation is around the corner, several of them are actually worried that inflation, already pretty low, is falling behind the target range that they think, that actually inflation could come too low to make them comfortable.
Meaning that they would like to keep interest rates lower if they could get below zero. Some people might like to do that for a little while. Is that what that means?
Yeah, actually, the Fed formulas for setting interest rates would dictate interest rates below zero. They just can't get there. So what this means is that the widespread expectations that the Fed is going to keep interest rates near zero through the end of the year are definitely reflected in these minutes. And it would take something extraordinary, a really welcome burst of economic growth or an unwelcome burst of inflation, to knock the Fed off that course so they would raise interest rates sooner.
But let's remember, David Wetzel, the Fed doesn't control all interest rates, only some of them. And even though the Fed is keeping its rates very low, we can read in the Wall Street Journal, say, that long-term mortgage rates and some other rates are actually going up.
That's right. The bond market is pushing up interest rates. The 10-year Treasury, a benchmark, is near 4%, which is higher than it's been. The Fed looks at that as a sign that the economy is inching towards normal, but businesses are borrowing again, and it also sees it as a kind of danger sign, a sign that investors are getting a bit anxious about the amount of borrowing that the U.S. government is doing to finance its massive budget deficit. In fact, Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, is speaking in Dallas this afternoon, and that's likely to be at the top of his worry list today.
Some of the clues in the numbers from David Wetzel of The Wall Street Journal, regular guest here. Sounds like your time is up, David. David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And we continue to get advice from David Wetzel whenever he's got the time. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
An update now on real estate. The housing bust has made it possible for many who want to own homes to jump into the market, at least in theory. But these entry-level buyers are facing stiff competition from professional house flippers and other investors. From member station KQED, Stephanie Martin reports.
California resident Andrew Cummings says he didn't understand why his wife, Akemi, was so set on owning a home until she took him to Japan and showed him the tiny shack where she grew up.
By American standards, it wasn't up to snuff. And basically, from then on, she's always had a dream of buying a house.
But when the couple married 10 years ago, that dream remained a distant one. They were living in San Francisco, one of the priciest real estate markets in the country. All they could afford was a studio apartment, and even that was $1,200 a month.
And this is while I was driving taxi cab, working in a plant nursery, doing landscape maintenance while I was in school for landscape architecture.
Cummings says after he graduated, they considered buying a small condo in Contra Costa County, a less expensive area about 45 minutes east of San Francisco. But the price tag was still too high at $325,000. Then late last year, as foreclosures in the county hit record levels and home prices plummeted, they resumed the search for a dream home. The problem this time, though, wasn't the price. It was the competition.
A lot of the places I looked at, I would always see like a Mercedes and a Lexus parked out front. And there's no way that somebody's driving a Mercedes was going to be buying the house that we were looking at.
Cummings repeatedly ran into and was beaten to the punch by what's known as vulture investors because of their appetite for foreclosures. Their goal? Refurbish the homes quickly and sell them for a profit.
1720, unit B.
Twice a day, each weekday, about two dozen or so gather on the steps of the Contra Costa County Courthouse to bid on local homes. They carry stacks of cashier's checks.
Yeah, we're all friends, sort of like attorneys, you know. They all smile and say hello to each other, but they cut each other's throat every chance they get. Same thing.
Scott Jones says he's been investing in homes for years, but right now, he and his competitors are especially hungry to make the most of the depressed market. They enter fierce bidding wars, driving up prices.
People are paying a lot of money for houses, making it very difficult to make money.
But making money is not what it's about for regular buyers like Andrew and Akemi Cummings. They just want a home. But they're at a disadvantage. Unlike professional investors, they'll have to live with any problems the house might have. All cash was never an option. Andrew Cummings says they found the perfect four-bedroom in Contra Costa for $200,000, made an offer, and watched with anguish as they lost it to an investor.
We're playing with our heartstrings here. This buying a home is our dream. And to get beat out, you know, for somebody just looking to make a quick buck, it's not a very good feeling.
This is my dream room.
Still, the house hunt had a happy ending, and the Cummings' daughter, Kaide, even got the pink bedroom she was hoping for.
And I have two kitchens. One...
Plenty of room for her toy kitchens with plastic pots and pans.
Big, big, big.
That's how Akemi Cummings describes the three-bedroom home they moved into last month. It's larger than anything she ever imagined living in. They found the home on an internet site, listed under the wrong county. They pounced, moving so quickly, vulture investors had no time to find out about it. The cost? $195,000. Now the Cummings hope they'll be on the right side of the home buying curve. At the peak of the housing boom, this house sold for over $500,000. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Martin.
And you can follow the foreclosure crisis by subscribing to our Planet Money podcast at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. And we begin this hour with the commission appointed by Congress to determine the cause of the 2008 financial crisis. Today, it turned its attention to subprime lending. First up in the hot seat, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. In a sometimes contentious hearing, Greenspan defended the Fed's policing of the subprime market and laid blame for the crisis elsewhere. NPR's John Idsty reports.
When Alan Greenspan used to make the trip from Federal Reserve headquarters up to Capitol Hill to testify, he got the royal treatment. Lots of congratulations, lots of adulation for presiding over a booming economy. Now that the boom has been redefined as a bubble, followed by maybe the worst financial crisis in history, things are different. After Greenspan's opening statement, Phil Angelides, the head of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, read a long bill of particulars— warnings the Fed had received starting in the late 1990s about problems in the subprime mortgage market, including these.
In January of 2000, both HUD and Treasury urged the Federal Reserve to use its authority under HOPA to curb abusive lending. In 2004, the FBI warned that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud that, if unchecked, could lead to losses greater than the S&L crisis. Why, in the face of all that, did you not act to contain abusive, deceptive subprime lending?
First of all, Mr. Chairman, we did.
Greenspan directed the commission's attention to a number of actions the Fed had taken, but Angelides maintained they only affected about 1% of the subprime market. In the end, Greenspan fell back to the position taken by a number of officials in the wake of the financial crisis.
We did do almost all of the things that you were raising. And the consequence of that is that I think things were better than they would have been. Were they enough to stop the surge in subprime lending?
No, they weren't, said the former Fed chairman. And the reason, he argued, can be traced to the Congress's decision to mandate that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do more to support the expansion of home ownership for low-income people. Greenspan said Fannie and Freddie responded by buying up 40% of the subprime mortgages in the market. That left Wall Street scrambling to get enough subprime mortgages to satisfy the market for mortgage-backed securities. And that led to the abuses in subprime lending and the subsequent defaults that sparked the credit crisis. In the end, though, Greenspan acknowledged he'd made some mistakes.
In the business I was in, I was right 70% of the time, but I was wrong 30% of the time. And there are an awful lot of mistakes in 21 years.
Still, the chairman argued, if 5 years ago the Fed had tried to forcefully tighten up on subprime mortgages just as the housing market was booming and home ownership was rising, the Congress would have clamped down on the Fed.
If in that midst of period of expanding home ownership, had we said we're running into a bubble and we have to start to retrench, Congress would say we haven't a clue what you are talking about.
As for prescriptions for overhauling financial regulation to avoid a repeat of the crisis, Greenspan endorsed raising capital and liquidity requirements, one of the main ideas that's in congressional reform proposals. That would mean financial firms would be required to have plenty of cash to meet their obligations and have big enough cushions set aside to absorb potential losses. It's hoped that will make it less likely taxpayers will be on the hook when big firms get into trouble. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.